Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, not as many high school seniors are filling out the FAFSA form this year after a messy federal rollout. And who's liable when someone completes suicide? We'll take a closer look at one case at a local high school. But first, Arizonans will get the chance to vote on whether or not to expand abortion across the state in November. The Arizona State Supreme Court ruled unanimously yesterday to allow the Arizona Abortion Access Act to appear on the ballot, rejecting a bid by abortion opponents to get it thrown off. Arizona Right to Life challenged the initiative on the grounds that it was overly broad and that the description of it on the petition used by signature gatherers was misleading to voters. But the justices all disagreed. The initiative will appear on the ballot as Proposition 139. The decision came as the court is under a lot of public and political scrutiny following months of high-stakes decisions on abortion that began when the court ruled to revive an 1864 near-total abortion ban in April of this year. But my first guest this morning says the decision is further proof that the court is not politically biased. Barbara Atwood is law professor emerita at the University of Arizona. I spoke with her earlier this morning more about it, beginning with the unanimous nature of the decision. Was that surprising to her?
It was not surprising, actually. I think what all seven justices were of the view that their role was pretty limited in assessing the validity of these of the description and the ballot measure itself. I think they much prefer that it be in the political arena, that that's something for the people to decide.
So let's talk about where politics and the state Supreme Court sort of intersect, a similar conversation to what's happening on the federal level right now. Tell us about the makeup of the Supreme Court itself. It's come under increasing scrutiny since it ruled back in April to revive an 1864 near total abortion ban that kind of led us down this road. It outraged a lot of people in the state. Supreme Court justices in Arizona are appointed by the governor, and every justice on the court today was appointed by a Republican governor. Is that right?
That is right. Two of the justices, Chief Justice Ann Temer and the former Chief Justice Brutinel, were appointed by Governor Jan Brewer, and the rest of the justices were appointed by Doug Ducey. And it was under Doug Ducey's administration that the court was expanded from 5-7, which was a controversial move itself. Mm-hmm. So all justices were appointed by Republican governors. That does not mean that they all agree or that they are trying to pursue political ends. I actually respect the members of the court deeply, and I think they are honest when they say what we're doing in this decision, the decision yesterday, and what they did in April was a result of an attempt at analyzing legislative intent and not a result of the justices' political or moral beliefs.
I want to talk about another case that's been in the public discussion about this in recent weeks here, because they made another decision recently allowing the state legislature's suggested language on this abortion measure to stay in the description of the measure that will go to voters. It uses the phrase unborn human being. This was challenged, saying that it's political language, but the state Supreme Court overturned the lower court ruling, actually, in this case, and said that they think it's fair and should stay. What do you make of that decision by the court, especially given, you know, the decision that they made in April that was so controversial?
Yes, that decision was actually assessing the validity of the brochure that the Arizona Legislative Council, this group of legislators, has come up with that the voters will receive. So it's actually quite important. It's a descriptive measure, but five members of the Arizona Supreme Court viewed it as acceptable and not unduly partisan. And I think one of the most helpful arguments for the Legislative Council, the folks who came up with this language, is that that very term, unborn human being, is used in existing Arizona law. The now well-known 15-week law uses that term. On the other side, of course, the arguments were that fetus is the much more commonly used term and is the medical term and is, of course, the term used in the proposed constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. There were two dissenters, two justices, including the now Chief Justice Ann Timmer, disagreed and would have affirmed the lower court, saying this is loaded and partisan and it should not be used. But of course, it's not the language that appears anywhere in the proposed constitutional amendment.
Right, right. Okay, so that's two decisions, right, on this front. And then we get the decision yesterday that kind of goes the other way, at least if you're looking at it through a political lens, and unanimous from the court saying that this measure should go to voters, that it's fair, it didn't break these laws. I wonder what you think the totality of these cases in front of the court in the last several months here says about the court itself. Do you think it shows a biased court?
I do not believe that it shows a biased court. I think it shows a divided court. It shows a court struggling with some uneven and sometimes ambiguous legislative directions. And particularly going back to the decision in April, that was a 4-2 decision with Justice Montgomery having recused. But that decision, I was rereading it today, and you can see the justices actually struggling to make sense of what the legislature had done. That, of course, produced a huge outcry that the court was biased and had voted its political or moral beliefs. I didn't see it doing that then, and I haven't changed my mind. I think the approving of the Legislative Council's terminology of unborn human being last week also angered some people who viewed it as very loaded language that might hurt the prospect of the constitutional amendment being approved by the voters,
right?
Because that language is in our statutes, you know. So that there's also arguments on both sides, although mm-hmm. it was a split court. And then yesterday's decision shows the court, I think, looking to stay out of the political arena and saying, look, the petition itself, the 200-word description, is accurate or accurate enough. And the impact of that proposed constitutional amendment is something that belongs in the political arena. So I think the three decisions together show a court struggling, but not one that's trying to accomplish some kind of political end.
I want to ask you about recusals, which have been a part of this, and you've mentioned a couple of times here. There have been questions about one justice in particular, former Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery, who has said some very inflammatory things about abortion rights in his past political career. And he did recuse himself back in April, as you mentioned. He did not this time, despite calls for it. What does that conversation do, you think, to trust in the court? And in fact, all of this, what do you think it does to the public's trust in the court?
Well, I think Justice Montgomery did recuse when Planned Parenthood was a direct party in the litigation back in April, and because of the statements he had made prior to becoming a justice regarding Planned Parenthood's work. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that was a very, very appropriate and necessary recusal. In the couple of recent cases here that the court was dealing with, I know people were calling for his recusal. That is, of course, always going to be up to the justice himself or herself. And apparently Justice Montgomery felt that he could rule impartially despite some of the comments he had made earlier. So he ended up, of course, not recusing himself and participating in the unanimous decision yesterday of keeping the ballot provision on the ballot. Mm-hmm. And that maybe shows something about his ability to separate himself from his prior comments and work as Maricopa County attorney. Yeah.
Let me ask you lastly here about the broader picture. There are efforts now at reform, right? Not just on the federal level, but here on the local level as well. There's an effort on the ballot to change the rules and allow judges to serve essentially life terms, not to be up for retention votes every several years. There are also efforts on the left to oust two of the justices who are up for retention votes from the state Supreme Court, two who voted to revive the 1864 near total abortion ban back in April. Do you think the court needs reforms? Do you think the public should trust it?
I think that the merit selection process that's been in place for a number of decades in Arizona, and has actually been a model for a lot of other states, is definitely something that we should keep. I think that the ballot initiative that is designed to remove the standard retention vote, the participation of the public in retaining these justices, is not something that should be supported. I definitely and deeply hope that those justices are retained. I am not a fan of voting out justices based on their participation in a single decision. I think, again, as I said earlier, I think the justices are trying to do their job and that we should respect that. And our disagreement with the particular outcome is not something that should be the basis of a vote to throw them off the court.
All right, we'll leave it there. Barbara Atwood, law professor emerita at the University of Arizona, joining us. Barbara, thank you for coming back on. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the invisible impact of informal green spaces.
When you look at a city park, it is very often expanses of grass that are watered and mowed. You're essentially obliterating that ecosystem every time you mow it. These more unkempt, informal sorts of green spaces have these thriving ecosystems.
A science writer will explain how those forgotten patches of dirt help humans and our desert pollinators. But first, an Arizona judge ruled earlier this summer that the Chandler Unified School District could not be the subject of a wrongful death lawsuit brought by one of the parents of a student who died by suicide in 2022. The suit alleged the Hamilton High School freshman had been the victim of bullying and harassment, but that the school did not do enough to stop it and protect the students. The school denied those allegations. The lawsuit also says the student's parents brought the situation to the school's attention. To explain the legal principles behind the decision, my co-host Mark Brody spoke with Betsy Gray, a law professor at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. And they started with what Arizona law says about the kinds of things a school district can be held liable for and those things for which it cannot.
So a school district has a duty to protect their students and provide a safe environment. So, in other words, when your kid goes to kindergarten, we don't expect the school to give them lead-based crayons because they could eat them and get poisoned. And if a school district fails in that duty and is negligent, then you, a parent, could bring an action for damages against the school district. Now, there is immunity for school districts for certain broader policy decisions, but not for those kinds of questions.
Well, so I guess the question then is, what is a reasonable standard of safety, right? Because in this case, the family of the student who died by suicide said the school should have done something about the fact that they and the student brought to the school's attention that this person was being bullied, for example, and being harassed, and the school, according to the family, again, didn't do anything.
Right. So, you know, bullying, as you know, has been on the rise in our schools in Arizona, across the country. And every state has some form of a duty or requirement, either through the common law or through a statute or regulation or maybe both, imposing a duty on school districts to control, to the extent they can, bullying on of their students. As I understand it, the parents in this very tragic situation were alleging that the school district was negligent in the way they were addressing the bullying concerns at the high school.
From a legal perspective, does the way that a school would try to address bullying make a difference? I mean, we know it makes a difference in terms of whether or not the behavior continues or not, but legally speaking, does it matter in what way the school tried to address it?
And honestly, I don't know exactly what the facts are in this case, so let me just say that at the outset. But yes, have they done enough? And what's reasonable to expect schools to do to try to control bullying? They're not going to be able to control bullying 100%. We see them as more responsible for controlling bullying on campus than off campus. I would suspect that a lot of the bullying goes on off campus, goes on through social media. Mm-hmm. And so the schools have less access to controlling that kind of behavior.
Do they also have less responsibility if something is not happening on school grounds or during school hours?
Probably.
One of the things that the student's family was quoted as saying, and I'm going to paraphrase it here, I'm not going to get it exactly right, was that basically they respect the court's decision, but feel that it's not, the law is not really keeping up with the reality in schools, and that essentially, you know, schools pay a lot of attention to students' mental health, and they recognize that suicide rates are unfortunately going up in this population, but maybe aren't quite doing enough, and maybe the law isn't requiring them to do enough. I'm curious what you make of comments like that.
The problem in this particular case is that the plaintiffs, the parents, I guess, were alleging that the school was negligent in failing to control the bullying behavior adequately. But the problem is that they're alleging that lack of control over the bullying was what led to or caused the student to commit suicide. And that is crossing another whole area of law that's very hard to overcome. And that is that we think of the law, thinks of suicide mostly as a very unpredictable or unforeseeable event, so that the argument under the law is that even if the defendant is negligent, the suicide is not a natural consequence of the defendant's negligence. Or we say in the law that the victim's suicide was superseding cause of death. In other words, it's the victim, him or herself, that causes the suicide, not the negligent behavior of the, in this case, school district here. And so, and this is a terrible name, but we call that the suicide rule. And basically, every jurisdiction in the country has some version of this suicide rule.
Is it the same kind of thinking, for example, if, let's say, one teen is bullying another and the teen that's doing the bullying eventually kills the student that they're bullying? Is that a different legal standard than if the bully is bullying the teen and the victim then goes and dies by suicide?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So if you are the tortfeasor who directly causes the death of a victim, you would be held responsible both civilly and probably criminally for that. But here, you were saying that the victim acted on his own. And this is a very complicated area of law that this is very deeply embedded in the law, this notion that we don't hold individuals responsible for somebody else's suicide. Now, you said at the beginning that the parents were disappointed and they thought that social views are changing here about bullying, and I assume they also meant about suicide. Mm-hmm. And that's true. I mean, that is true. Now, there are gradually, we're creating in the law some minor exceptions to that rule, and we see these certain exceptions breaking through.
Do you think that as, you know, people continue to think about mental illness, especially among students, and the problem of suicide, is this an area you think that more states will take a look at in their laws? And if not, you know, confer full responsibility on school districts, maybe sort of inch in that direction, as you suggested some places are doing?
I personally think that as a policy matter, that would be a good change, that you know, like you said, our social views on suicide are changing. We're seeing it more as a public health issue than we did previously. And so maybe to address this big public health issue, maybe we should be going, you know, one avenue to address it would be to go through the schools. And so I think that, like I said, as a deterrence value, maybe this is a great way to, or at least a one way to address that problem.
All right. That is Betsy Gray, a professor of law at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Betsy, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
College classes are starting for many students around the country this week, and thousands of students are moving into their dorms here in Arizona. But fewer Arizona high school graduates have applied for free federal aid to pay for it. In fact, Arizona ranks 50th in the nation when it comes to FAFSA completion rates, or the free application for student aid. About 36% of Arizona seniors have filled out the form so far, according to the National College Attainment Network. FAFSA has been something of a mess this year, after the federal government completely revamped the form at the order of Congress. They were aiming to make it easier to fill out and more accessible, but the process has been plagued with problems, delays in when the form opened, glitches, and long wait times to get help. Since the Arizona Board of Regents, or ABOR, received $1 million in federal funding from the Department of Education to boost FAFSA completion rates, but our next guest says it came too late. Christina Guy is a counselor at West Mech High School, as well as chair of the Arizona School Counselors Association. And I spoke with her more about these low completion rates and what she's seeing on the ground.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of lack of education around the FAFSA. And so we have a high number of parents that don't complete it because they think they make too much money, or they don't complete it because they don't want to give their information to the government through this format. And so there's a lot of unknowns, I believe, with parents that they don't have their students complete the FAFSA because they don't understand the benefits that could come with it.
So talk a little bit about those benefits and explain for us why this is so important, like why a big part of a counselor's job like yours is to try to help kids find out where they're going to go and what they need to do to get there. But this is a part of that process.
Yeah, so filling out the FAFSA is really important, not just for the grants that you could get through the Department of Education or the different loans at lower interest rates than a private organization might give, but oftentimes when the colleges get this money, they can give scholarships or grants that the student or parent might not have even known existed. They might have different income thresholds than the FAFSA grant threshold is. So it really just opens up more opportunities that are kind of unknown or hidden. Same thing with some private scholarships that ask for your information from FAFSA. They might be able to offer you more money that the student or parent might not have even known was out there.
So there's been a big decrease in particularly first-generation students, low-income students, students from kind of mixed-status families. That's a big population in Arizona in particular, and we've seen fewer of those students fill out FAFSA this year. Are you seeing that as well?
Most definitely. I think that the change of October 1 to pushing up the open date didn't help, especially because we didn't know when it was going to open. We were just told it has to open by December 31st. So school counselors on a campus were just kind of in limbo of trying to get students ready, but we didn't know when they needed to be ready. And there was also a fear that the system was going to crash right when it opened. So right. It was kind of that, do I have them start it right when it opens? Do I have them wait a week or 2 weeks? Because there was just so much unknown about it. And when we start getting into these families that we're talking about, they don't know what they don't know. When we're talking about first generation, their parents never went through this process, even though it looks different now, they don't know how to help them. They don't know that they need to help them sometimes. When we're getting into mixed status students, trying to get that FSA ID or that electronic signature login, that couldn't even happen until the application went live. And then when the application went live, there were so many issues with trying to get those families that FSA ID for that parent, or as they're now calling it, a contributor. And so a lot of these students that typically struggle filling this out had so many more challenges that were unforeseen and really made it undesirable that families just didn't even want to try because of how hard it was.
I wonder, like, what are they doing instead for the students of yours who have not filled out these forms, or of other counselors? Like, do they just not go to college? Do they find something else to do? Do they just pay more than they would have otherwise?
So being at a CTED, like I've mentioned, my kids leave with certifications and licenses. So we actually just had a student on campus this morning who I had met with in May, who still didn't receive a financial aid offer and decided it was too much money for him to go and commit to a school uninformed. So he's working this year and he's going to try the process again when it opens up in December.
Wow. So ABOR and the federal government have tried to resolve this in recent months since the sort of, you know, mess of the rollout. They have, you know, $1 million in federal funding. They've been trying to get the message out to help more people fill out the form. And they've reported that that's helped. It's resulted in about a 30% increase in FAFSA completions. Have you seen that working?
Yeah, so I think the rollout from the U.S. Department of Education and from ABOR was a little late, not of anything I think that they could have predicted because of what happened. But when that happens, students are typically gone. So for us to be able to reach them, it was a little harder. I know ABOR did a lot of work of having application workshops around the whole state in rural areas, because I feel like that was one of our hardest hit areas. And I know that the Department of Education had a FAFSA hotline that people could call in and get live help. And so I felt like they were doing what they could. But even the U.S. Department of Education didn't know some of the challenges until April or May. I was on a call, a panel with the U.S. Department of Education and several counselors from around the country. And they were all talking about some of the issues that they had. And the U.S. Department of Education didn't know those were issues. There was a pocket of kids who filled out their FAFSA application early in the spring semester. And for whatever reason, they sat and they didn't get processed. And so another counselor figured out, just have them go in and add a college. Even if they're not going to go there, add a college. And so I started telling some of my students and counselors at other campus, and those kids got processed like almost immediately. And U.S. Department of Education didn't know that was happening. And so I think that the effort that they put in at the end was helpful. We did see that spike, but it was just late. It was late for a lot of counselors to be able to access those students.
Yeah. So looking toward next year, like, what are your concerns? What are your hopes here? Like you said, you have one student who's going to try again next time around, right? Like, do you hope this will be better next time around?
I certainly hope it's better. I know that the actual process of filling out the application was much easier last year. That wasn't all of the issues. It was a lot of the back end with the Department of Ed. So I'm hoping that they have those resolved. A lot of students that filled it out early, they miscalculated their formula. And so it said students were not eligible for grants, and they were, because they got it out so late to universities. They didn't award their financial aid packages until early to mid-May. So my hope is that this goes back to a somewhat normal timeline, that kids are getting their financial aid packages in February, March, even though that's later, it's still earlier than it was this past school year.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. Christina Guy, WestMEC counselor and chair of the Arizona School Counselors Association. She's also National Career and Technical Education Counselor of the Year this year. Christina, thank you so much for coming on and explaining this to us. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. This fall, ASU will welcome a new class of grad students to a brand new program with a distinctly futuristic name, Space Architecture. It's led by Professor Elena Roki. As Roki recently told the show's Sam Dingman, in her mind, the future is already here.
We don't have just to reinvent architecture. We need to reinvent shelter in the connection with the new society that we'll establish. The history of architecture depends a lot on the way we have been gathering. And we plan to be on the moon in 2030, if not earlier.
Wow.
But yeah, exactly. And each individual student will carry on a personal research. It might involve the construction of an emergency room. Mm-hmm. It might involve the design of a spacesuit. Mm-hmm. It might involve the design of how robots can build a future hotel. One of the students that applied to the program is interested in disabilities in space. We opened this master because we are expecting the students actually to pose questions to us.
Yeah. Boy, it's so interesting, though. I mean, this idea that you're having to build for a speculative future that once seemed so far-fetched, but now, as you're saying, it may be within the realm of the next 5 years or so.
Yeah.
One of the things I find fascinating about this is I was looking at the qualifications to be an astronaut, which are very intense. You have to have a master's degree in a STEM field. You have to have 3 years of related professional experience. You have to complete what is known to be a very, very rigorous physical exam. Obviously, if long-term life on the moon is going to be viable, we're not going to be able to hold everybody to that standard. How much is human frailty something that you're taking into account as you think about talking to your students about this?
It is very difficult, your question, because I have a different point of view.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean that the students are going to be up there, but someone down here needs to avoid the mistakes that we did when we actually went out our own continent and conquered.
Mm-hmm.
Someone needs to put humanity at the center of this conversation. So how do we profess religion when we are an international space station? What are the spaces where we can feel safe? What are the ways that we can reinvent a new society? But how will we respect what we encounter and avoid the many mistakes that we have done in the past? We are not colonizing anything. We are not going there to colonize. We are going there to actually find some resources that will help us to continue to be humans.
That makes a lot of sense. And it seems really revolutionary is the word that's coming to mind. I mean, there's this way in which, and tell me if you think I'm going too far with this or being too grandiose, but there is kind of a chance to build a human utopia in a way, because life there will be starting from scratch in a way.
Exactly. You know, I'm always thinking that this master is the opportunity to bridge the gap between theory and practical application. As a faculty of architecture that started to engage with the Interplanetary Initiative, I noticed the architects, we didn't, you know, take part of the conversation because these initiatives are not necessarily focusing on sheltering the human body, but more about, you know, how robots are going to be launched and then start to create a new material that can probably be used for creating the future bricks. And eventually these robots can start 3D printing a shelter that will protect us from radiation. And then eventually we can land. But what is the role of the humans when they are placed at the center of all this conversation? So,
right.
Right. Because I can imagine there are ways that robots would be more resilient than humans, and also ways in which they would be less resilient than humans.
No, absolutely. But they're going to, in any case, they're going to be manipulated by humans. And so it's that input.
Yeah.
That input for me is fundamental. That's why I think it's important that humans are actually there at the center of this conversation. And architects, industrial designers, interior designers, artists, we can gather in this program and start to actually create a kind of interface for a conversation, a common conversation starting to happen. You know, the future for me is to formulate the right questions. So I hope that the master of science and design of space architecture and stream environments can contribute to formulate better questions.
Yeah.
Remember that if you read our webpage, it starts by saying that everything we do in space is for the Earth.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, the foundational philosophy of this program is not the idea that life in space will one day replace life on Earth, but rather that the two will be in conversation with each other.
Absolutely. Like, we always thought about, you know, going beyond the credo, and I'm speaking of the credo as of the Earth, having a distance, having a perspective makes you think better of the things you have. You know, I'm a foreigner, I'm an Italian architect that traveled to Barcelona, and now it's 11 years and I'm in Arizona. I have always the same ideas, but because of the place I'm having them is different, made me understand the values of my ideas. So for us, exploring and investigating and going on the moon is all in a sort of gaining reflection on what we are doing on Earth. All the time, I think what is very interesting of this master is the constant dialogue between the credo and beyond the credo, if it makes sense.
It does make sense. Thank you, Dr. Elena Rocchi, head of the Space Architecture and Extreme Environments Program at the Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts at ASU. Really appreciate you sharing these big ideas with us.
Thank you, Sam. Have a wonderful day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Weeds are something we're supposed to get rid of, but our next guest says if you see green spaces around the city that seem to be full of weeds, not so fast. Matt Simon is a senior staff writer for Grist, and in a recent piece, he takes a closer look at these so-called informal green spaces, from empty lots to the median of the road to the greenery that grows on the edges of sidewalks. And he found they're highly underrated by humans and important to other urban species like pollinators. I spoke with him more about it.
So the beauty of these informal green spaces is that they're everywhere, and we probably haven't really noticed them just walking by them. You could most easily define it as an unplanned sort of green space, in contrast to an official city park that is managed. These are roadsides, empty lots, even smaller strips of land that might just look like weeds might actually be hosting a good amount of biodiversity, and we just don't really notice it.
That's really interesting. So there's been some research done about this that you've reported on. Talk about where we find these most in an urban landscape. Does it depend on the city, or do we kind of like, can you count on finding them in certain places?
It's really going to depend on the city. Yes. Yeah. So this new research looked at Melbourne, Australia. So they went out and calculated how much of this informal green space there is. But they also brought in this anonymized cell phone data for a naturalist app. So like iNaturalist has an app where you can use your phone to identify plants and animals. So they took that data and actually were able to say, okay, this is how much people are engaging with these informal green spaces versus these formal green spaces like parks. And they actually found that the engagement was similar. So people are stopping to notice these informal green spaces, even though they might be a little bit invisible to a lot of us. So it's going to depend on the city. A place like Phoenix probably has a very different kind of vegetation than Melbourne. Yeah. Australia does. Some people have more parks. They're lucky enough to have that, maybe fewer informal green spaces. But yeah, even within a city, just naturally, it just is the case that a lot of these underserved neighborhoods just don't have proper parks. It was just designed that way by the cities, unfortunately. So these informal green spaces might be particularly powerful there, that these residents can actually enjoy those in the absence of these sort of formal parks.
Right. So there's a benefit for the people who live around them, right? But there's also this really interesting kind of ecosystem question to this. Like, these can be good for local ecosystems in various ways. Outline that for us.
They can be very good indeed. So what, again, looks to you and me like a pile of weeds is actually a thriving ecosystem. So a lot of those, I mean, hopefully a lot of those plants are native vegetation and they're playing host to native pollinators. When you look at a city park, it is very often expanses of grass that are watered and mowed. You're essentially obliterating that ecosystem every time you mow it. These more unkempt, informal sorts of green spaces have these thriving ecosystems, and it can actually have been thriving for decades at a time. They point out in this research that along railways, you get a lot of this sort of vegetation that isn't really managed, other than keeping trees falling on the tracks, of course. Also, the sorts of strips of land underneath high voltage power lines, that could be growing for a very, very long time and playing host to these really mature ecosystems where over the course of the seasons, you get certain plants growing, certain flowers flowering. That comes and goes with the season. It brings in pollinators and other species. It's a really dynamic place. And I think that's why there are so many people who are walking by them, noticing these things and taking pictures with their phones for scientists to later find and make these really interesting findings.
Right. I love that those are aggregated and you can figure out what people are doing with those kinds of apps. Talk about rainwater and like a cooling aspect to these. There was a little bit of that in this research too, which is obviously very interesting to those of us here in very hot Phoenix.
Right. So we get these improvements for mental health, of course. Any sort of green space in a city is going to boost the mental health of residents. We are just programmed for greenery. Our brains have evolved in that sort of thing. But we also get these interesting co-benefits. So you mentioned that this sort of dirt can actually absorb rainwater. So in a place like Phoenix, when you get those monsoons, that deluge of water, if you have more of these patches of land that aren't really pasted over with concrete, that allows that water to soak down into aquifers to be later extracted in times of drought. That also mitigates flooding in a neighborhood. If you have less concrete, there's less opportunity for that water to pool and cause flooding. So as these plants are also growing, they are releasing water, which is just a natural part of photosynthesis. And when that happens, it cools the surrounding air. It's essentially the plants are sweating and cooling down a landscape, and that is bringing down temperature. So not only are these spaces really good for people to engage with, they're actually good for just having as part of infrastructure and improving physical health for people as well.
I love that they show up kind of spontaneously. It's like the plants that want to grow there will grow there.
Yeah. And ideally that's a native plant, right?
Right.
That is perfectly adapted for a place like Phoenix to grow. It's been doing that for millennia. Let's get more of those plants growing. So in a lot of cases, I think there will be room for these informal green spaces to be somewhat formalized in the sense that even local residents, the city might pay people to come in and manage these spaces to foster more native species. And then those, of course, attract native species of wildlife as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I wonder this because you've been reporting on this. Do you walk around your neighborhood like I did and sort of think about these areas differently, where I might have been annoyed that there were weeds before? I was like, maybe this is a good thing.
I do. It's eye-opening and maybe a little bit too eye-opening. I walk around in judgment. That species doesn't look native. What is it doing here? I'm in San Francisco. I live out in the kind of the western part of the city where it used to be sand dunes. We didn't have like a lush forest ecosystem here before humans came along, but we did have some species. So I'm lucky to be near Golden Gate Park, which is this massive formal park, but it is in a lot of ways highly planned. They brought in a lot of non-native species to make it look beautiful, but that is not a thriving ecosystem. And in these informal spaces that I see in my neighborhood, just in between the sidewalk and the road, you have the potential for, especially as people coming around and planting them themselves, to get native species in there and not replicate what these ecosystems used to look like before right. humans came along, but to certainly do it in a more sustainable way than properly planning a giant park and bringing in a lot of non-native species. Don't get me wrong, I love Golden Gate Park. It's a phenomenal place.
It's beautiful, yeah.
But it was designed, over a century ago when they weren't thinking about native species and invasive species.
Yeah, all right. Well, it gives us all a different perspective here. Matt Simon, Senior Staff Writer for Grist, joining us to talk more about these informal green spaces all around us. Matt, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And thanks for having me.
Little love letter to weeds there for your Wednesday. We will be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more as always. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. If you heard a song you liked on today's show, you can follow us on Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app and find our monthly playlists. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.